Well, good morning again. My name is Jean Jeffress. I, as Lewis told you, I come to you from First Congregational Church of Oakland, where I bring you greetings from our congregation this morning. I am a recent graduate of American Baptist Seminary of the West at the GTU in Berkeley, California, and I am a member in discernment with the Northern California Nevada Conference of the United Church of Christ. And so if everything goes well, I will be what they call ordained pending call sometime early next year. So that's very exciting. And so that's a little bit about me. I'm very happy to be with you all this morning. Thank you so much for being so welcoming and welcoming me into your community. I do have a message for you today that, I have a story for you today. Sometimes I preach a sermon, and sometimes I tell a story, and sometimes I do a little of both. I think I've got the little of both thing going on today. I used to just only preach from the Gospels, but I've been expanding my horizons and preaching from the Hebrew Bible and from the epistles lately, and so this is my part of my early expansion, if you will, into Hebrew Bible preaching. This is called Limp Away Changed. And I think that most everybody likes a good story. That's what I think. I think that people like a story that sucks you in, where you forget, maybe just even for the moment, about the rest of the world. And, of course, everybody has their own ideas about what constitutes a good story. There are some stories that are plot-driven, where the characters are either good or they are evil, and there's not much nuance to their character, not much gray area. That old TV show, Walker, Texas Ranger, comes to mind. Remember that show, Walker, Texas Ranger? Walker, the main character, played by Chuck Norris, is absolutely good, no gray area. No corrupt leanings. He's never on the take. Always helps the helpless. And he literally beats the bad guys with his martial arts. Now, I love crime shows, so at one time I watched Walker, Texas Ranger, so I can tell you from firsthand experience that the show is not terribly interesting, the story, the overall arc of the story. And yes, I did watch the whole thing, I confess. And in fact, it got less interesting as I went along. Now, because ultimately what happened was Walker and the very, very bad men who were after him had a great battle in the finale, and Walker won the end. So if there are any Walker, Texas Ranger fans out here today, please bear in mind this is my opinion. And if you like the show, I watched it too, so hey. But that's an example of the type of story where it's good and it's evil and there's no gray area. And some stories offer a bit more nuance. So even when the characters behave badly toward each other, sometimes we get a little insight into what has happened to the character and what makes that person tick. Because life has nuance and people are complicated. The story that comes to mind here is A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. And we all know A Christmas Carol. Ebenezer Scrooge is a total jerk. He's greedy and he's mean-spirited, he's cruel and he's stingy, and he has no regard whatsoever for those less fortunate than himself. And we don't like him when the story starts out. Nobody likes him. But then we get to see what kind of life Scrooge had. That he was a lonely boy, rejected by his father, who lost his sister and poured himself into his work. And then, because of his own ambitions, he loses his love. And then he pours himself even more into his work and into making money and trying to control everything. He has lost his way. And this character has a very important arc that culminates in the struggle he experiences on the Christmas Eve night when the spirits come. And that's when that all unfolds. And Scrooge, He had to struggle that whole night with who he had been and what he had become. And he had to face the very real consequence that he may well die alone, unloved, because of how he chose to live his life. Scrooge had to wrestle with the reality of his life if he was going to really change. And the very great writer, James Baldwin, said, "There is nothing that can, not," he said, "not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced." And I'm wondering if any of you thought today when you came to church that you would be hearing about both Chuck Norris and Charles Dickens in the same sermon. Probably not, but I like to mix it up. In today's text, Jacob has come face to face with some things that he has done. And part of this story of Jacob that we drop into, it hinges on this nighttime struggle, where we are told that a man wrestled with Jacob until daybreak. But, you know, we can't really talk about Jacob wrestling with the man in this part of the story unless we talk about how he came to be in the situation in the first place. We just kind of drop in, and Jacob's wrestling with a man, and it's just sort of isolated. But if we go way back in the book of Genesis to chapter 25, we begin to learn about Jacob and his older brother Esau. Jacob and Esau are twins. They are the sons of Isaac, who is the son of Abraham, you know, the Abraham, of the God of Abraham. So these are all key characters in the arc of the Hebrew Bible narrative. But that doesn't keep this from being a very dysfunctional family mess of a story. And the story is not without its nuance, and there are a number of key factors that contribute to the behavior of the characters of this story and to the way it unfolds. Before Jacob and Esau are even born, their mother, a woman called Rebekah, could feel the twins struggling in her womb, and she heard the voice of God say, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples born of you shall be divided, and one shall be stronger than the other, and the elder shall serve the younger." Now bear in mind that in the cultural context of this story, the eldest son was the most important child in the family. He would inherit 2/3 of the family's wealth. He would receive the father's blessing, and he would be the master of the house after the father died, and all of the siblings would serve him. That's just the way it was. That's the way it was. And of course, the women inherited nothing and could be married off for some goats or cows or something, but that's another sermon. And given this cultural norm of the eldest son's importance and his place and his birthright, so just how is the eldest going to serve the youngest? What is God up to? That is always the question, isn't it? And from the moment these boys are born, the struggle is on. Esau was born first, and Jacob, the text tells us, comes out of the womb with his little hand clutching onto Esau's heel. See, the word Jacob means, it's not only his name, but it also means to overreach. It means to supplant. So the foreshadowing has been set from birth that something is going to happen to disrupt the status quo, which privileges the eldest child. And of course, you know, people and family relationships being what they are, this family is far from perfect. Esau is favored by his father, while Jacob, the youngest, is favored by his mother. Esau is a hunter with great physical strength, while Jacob is a more stay-at-home guy who cooks and does quiet activities. And one day, Esau comes home from a long day of hunting. He's tired. He's sweaty. He's hungry. He's in no condition to make life-changing decisions. Jacob has been home all day cooking and hanging out. He's not tired. He's probably not hungry because he's probably been snacking all day while he cooks, like you do. So Esau says, "Hey, can I have some of that soup you made?" And Jacob says, "Yeah, but first, you have to agree to give me your birthright. Now, who in the world sells their birthright for a bowl of soup? It happens. Miguel de la Torre, who was a professor of ethics at Iliff Theological Seminary in Denver, Colorado, speculates that Esau may have believed that this agreement, which was made under duress, would never have been upheld by his father. So he tells Jacob, sure, you can have my birthright. And he takes the soup. We can also ask the question, what kind of a person bribes his tired, hungry brother with food? Well, when you're the youngest child, you take power wherever you get it. Trust me, I am the youngest of seven. And you do what you gotta do. You wonder why the youngest are tattletales. Well, let me tell you, it's the only power we have. I was a terrible tattletale. But that was the only leverage I had. I'm telling. And then when mom and dad are out of the room, you get beat up again for telling. So, you know. So this trickery and this deceit that Jacob engages in makes the story much more realistic in the context of a family dynamic than if they all just somehow understood that it was God's will for Esau to serve Jacob, and then they all just blithely obeyed. There would be no struggle or conflict in the story. It would be so boring. Every good story tells you exactly what the main character wants, and then it takes it away. And the clincher detail here is the part of the story that Jacob tricks his father Isaac into giving him Esau's blessing. Jacob goes to his father, who is blind and on his deathbed, and he lies to his father to his face, and he says, I am Esau. And Isaac gives Esau's blessing to Jacob. Now we have to wonder about this a little bit. This text tells us that it is God's will that the eldest son will serve the youngest. But the cultural norm says the eldest son will inherit the bulk of the wealth and become the master of the house, and that the rest of the children will serve the eldest. So how can they both be? How can they both be? Miguel de la Torre, the fellow I just mentioned, he talks about the use of the trickster in the Genesis narrative. The trickster is used to subvert a dominant paradigm, sometimes to uncover something that is hidden, sometimes to correct an injustice, but always to expose the flaws in systems that privilege some over others. Esau over Jacob. Sometimes we have to buck the system. Sometimes we have to turn the tables in the temple. Sometimes we have to put our bodies where they are not wanted, in the streets or in the hallways of Congress, to expose the flaws in systems that privilege some lives over others. Now, when Esau found out what Jacob had done, he was furious, as he would be. After all, he had been stripped of his birthright, stripped of his privilege. And this is why when we drop into the story in today's passage, we find Jacob returning home because he had to leave. Esau was in a murderous rage, and I don't know if he would have killed Jacob, but I do know that I have been really, really mad at my sister before. Really mad. Like, really mad. Have you ever been really mad at your brother or sister? Really, really mad. Family really knows how to push your buttons, don't they? I mean, I remember when my oldest sister and my brother, one of my brothers, would fight. And my older brother was like Esau. He was a big, strong guy. Big, and Esau, they say in the text, was hairy. And my brother was hairy. He was a big, strong, hairy guy. And he used to be able to hold a dining room chair with one arm, like a lion tamer, if you remember those images. And he would hold it out at my sister when they fought. He'd be like, come on. And she would get, she was so mad. And she would scream, I'm going to kill you. And she would chase him, and he would run in the door, and he ran in the door. He locked the door of the bathroom. And from that day forward, to the day we sold our house after my parents died, there was a little mark in the door that represented my oldest sister's right fist. We get really, really mad at our siblings. Really mad. So Jacob got what he wanted. But the price was that he had to leave his family. He went to live with his uncle Laban. He worked for his uncle and he lived with the family. He stayed there for 15 or 20 years and he married two of his cousins and had children with them and two of their servants because, you know, the Bible says that marriage is between one man and one woman. Okay, that's probably another sermon too. Anyway, after a time, Jacob wanted to come home. He was ready to face the music. And he was still afraid of Esau, and so he sent gifts of herds with his sermons out to try to sweeten the deal with Esau so that Esau would not be so mad at him anymore. But the servants came back to Jacob, and they said, you know, Esau's out there with 400 guys. So Jacob split his family into camps, and he sent them out ahead, hoping that if Esau did freak out and killed one camp, then at least the other would survive. Jacob was afraid. And then Jacob was alone at the bank of the river with his thoughts, alone with his deeds, perhaps for the first time in many years since he had left home. Jacob may have bucked the system all those years ago to fulfill the will of God, which was at odds with the status quo, the system that privileged his brother over him. But no matter what the reason, he still betrayed his brother. And there is a cost when we seek to answer God's call. There is a cost. Every person that I know who works for the cause of justice in an unjust world, whether it's racial justice, gender justice, economic justice, housing justice, healthcare justice, whatever the cause, there is always a price tag on their personal relationships and their reputation and on their safety. So when we drop into this story, we are told that a man wrestled with Jacob until daybreak. And we don't know the blow-by-blow of the wrestling match. We just know that it went on for hours. And then the man, whoever the man is, since he can't beat Jacob outright, he smacks him in his leg and dislocates his hip. But Jacob does not let go. He demands a blessing. Jacob is nothing if not tenacious and consistent. Again, with the blessing. He demands his blessing. And two things happen. First, the man says, from now on, you will be called Israel. So Jacob is no longer the one who overreaches. He is no longer the supplanter. He is Israel, the one who wrestles with God. And second, Jacob limps away, changed. He limps away, ready to face the role to which God has called him and ready to face his brother. And this story is not born out of definitive good facing off with definitive evil. It wouldn't work for a Walker Texas Ranger plotline. The story is born out of the gray area of flawed people trying to do the right thing in an unjust system, of imperfect family members struggling to get along and not doing a very good job. It is a story about sacrificing what is comfortable for what is right. It is a story about something that is dishonest for the sake of exposing injustice. It is a messy human story. But what we can take away from this story is that God is in the mess with us. Do not let go when you are struggling with the messy things of life. Wrestle and hang on. Don't look for what is good or what is evil. Look for where is God. And hang on to that. And if you feel uncomfortable or uncertain, if you wonder if you have offended someone because you may have bucked the system a little to expose injustice, if you find that you feel ready to face something that you are still unsure about or that perhaps you even fear, if you find that you are limping away, hopefully figuratively, from a struggle with God, then you have been blessed. God calls us not to be comfortable, but to be changed by God and with God to become the people of God. Amen.